Good evening, this is Dr. Daniel J. Guerra, and this is Authentic Biochemistry Podcast. This will be chapter number 15 in our mosaic number 3 on the inflammasomes. So we were cut off a little bit prematurely at the end of last lecture, but I was just getting into running into the full dialectic between what we were discussing with gravity and the production of photons relative to the eclipse that was occurring on Monday, which was, of course, yesterday. And I was going to then dive right into the complexity of sphingomyelinase-mediated inflammasome activation to show that we clearly have much more information about what's going on biochemically that causes inflammation and, therefore, many of the aspects of morbidity in human disease. Then we do something that is relatively macro in scale, certainly gets the attention of everybody when it occurs, and that is a full solar eclipse. But we did spend enough time talking about gravity and the speed of the sun and the solar system and the earth and the moon and the various juxtapositions. We also gave you that very cursory understanding of how photons are generated by the fusion of two protons initially, right? So let's go back and talk about the inflammasome and listen once again to how the epistemological associations of how we get into understanding that knowledge base, which is a discussion of the mosaic of inflammation in human disease, really requires a great deal of knowledge that generates higher level components of truths which are coherent and foundational and therefore can act as the event structure to build larger and larger understandings of how living systems function. And that's what I'm trying to do with this concept of mosaic in using biochemistry as the foundation of living systems. So I think that's enough of a introduction, right? So let's put this together again. You have variable signaling cascades from the acidic sphingomyelinase. And what the product of that is ceramide. Ceramide via the inflammasome will then activate caspase 1, which will then release interleukin 1 beta and interleukin 18. And that is all what I was describing as paradigmatic inflammatory immunology. Very, very basic, of course, what I just went through. Now, the implementation, here's an experiment, of an cystic fibrosis transmembrane conductance regulator gene deficient murine model, that's CFTR is the name of that gene, the acronym for it, and also using human CF lung samples, experiment using those two tissues, and one of them being an intact animal, suggested that a priori accumulation of ceramide results in caspase 1 protein level upregulation, and then the translocation of the protein to the luminal membrane in the epithelium in those CF mice. Moreover, that the ASC protein is elevated in the lungs of those CFTR deficient mice. Obviously, what that means is ceramide accumulation leads to inflammasome activation, and that it's consistent with ceramide triggering the activation of the inflammasome, and subsequently the generation and secretion of pro-inflammatory cytokines, as well as the permeability of the alveolar epithelial cells. And that ASM-generated ceramide-enriched membrane domains may directly induce recruitment and clustering of that ASC protein, hence the presumed increase in molar concentration of that protein in the membrane, to initiate finally the activation of the inflammasome, which is similar to CD95 or CD40 mediated responses. So the association of the ASC and ceramide may then lead to the downstream activation of caspase 1. So that means the ASM ceramide axis may act in an indirect way as well as a direct way to regulate the inflammasome because of the CD95, CD40 increase in the membrane as well, you see. That's in association with activating the inflammasome, just like ASC is associated with caspase 1 activation. Yes. So once again, what do we see? The space-time nature of ASM, acidic sphingomyelinase inflammasome axis, of a controlled response to a stimulation becomes a sequence of events, while highly programmed and regulated processes nevertheless leaves multiple biochemical footprints in the membrane. And the entire metabolic systems domain, including intermediary metabolism, bioenergetics, signaling, gene expression, and cell fate, all of those systems being impacted by that acidic sphingomyelinase conducting that early production of the sphingolipid, highly non-porous sphingolipid, ceramide. Remember, ceramide causes, along with cholesterol, mobilization of that membrane lipid raft, which is all important for the full activation via the PRR toll-like receptors, inflammasome induction. Now let's go back and talk about Staph aureus again. Staphylococcus aureus alpha toxin is a pore-forming protein that triggers membrane permeabilization, instantiating global inflammation, and hence alpha toxin stimulation results in a sustained acidic sphingomyelinase activation, and thence the release of ceramide, now locating to the lysosomes where all this action is taking place. So the release of the lysosomal ceramide upon exposure of cells to the Staph alpha toxin induces permeabilization of the lysosome and trafficking of a lysosomal hydrolase cathepsin D and B to the cytoplasm, whereupon both cathepsin D and B are released, and only cathepsin B associates, only that hydrolase associates with ASC. And this is all now in the cytoplasm. It used to be in the lysosome. And, of course, with the inflammasome protein, NLR, CARD domain-containing protein. Here, that particular protein is NLRC isoform 4. And that's what induces the release initially of interleukin 1 beta. So this sequence of events is annihilated by knockout of the ASM gene. Or, if the cells are pretreated with the pharmacological inhibitor amitriptyline. And that all suggests the importance of ASM in the induction of the pro-inflammatory cytokines in macrophages when they are given an S. aureus alpha toxin challenge. Okay? So they use the inhibitor, or they simply just did a KO of ASM. And they were able then to limit the pro-inflammatory cytokine production in macrophages after the alpha toxin challenge. So you see how this is able to be put together by very careful experimentation with all the appropriate controls. Now, I'll say furthermore, ceramide has previously been shown to induce lysosomal activation of cathepsin B, which is related to endoplasmic reticulum stress. And that whole process generates autophagy. And eventually, if autophagy does not complete the task of stress response recovery, apoptosis. such that there appears to be an a priori dialectic of stress and ASM linking the alpha toxin-induced cathepsin B activation. And I call it a priori because it's already arranged at the molecular level and subcellular level to be turned on. This is just yet another component of how inflammasomes are activated. So you see, there are multiple integrative axes where the full production of inflammasome-induced inflammation requires lysosomal activity, plasma membrane activity, and the acid sphingomyelinase myelinase being able to move between those compartments, and that ceramide has to be released in order to complete the production of the cathepsin-mediated hydrolase activity inducing the inflammasome. Okay? So once again, I'm showing you the complexity so that you can appreciate that any pharmacotherapeutic event to try to circumvent hyperinflammation needs to be carefully administered temporally and spatially, and therefore requires a tight control over the four categories: quantity, quality, modality, and relation, because each of those are being affected during the normal inflammasome activation and then recovery. Of course, the recovery is all these proteins turn over, right? And the membrane lipid raft eventually goes back and sequesters many of these polypeptide components back into the plasma membrane or into the ER membrane, hence disaggregating the platform that was then the inflammasome, either proximal to the activation and aggregation components in the inflammasome or distal to it. I always tell you that both proximal and distal nature of a biochemical event are both impacted as that event is occurring, because of the utilization of the various components and then running them through their activation and aggregation and sequestration coefficients so that the next step in the process can occur faithfully in the cell. And when you add a pharmacotherapeutic agent to, say, knock out one of the cathepsins, what do you think might happen to all those other components I just went through? Well, they're all going to be obviously affected. And that effect finally could be all the way from somewhat subtle to absolutely disconcerting to the regulation. And the only way we ever would know that is once it's delivered to the system and it's played through. And even then, we're not considering the alterations of epigenetic markup at the level of DNA and siRNA and long non-coding circular RNA and the membrane lipid raft components themselves, epigenetically modified by altering the transcriptome and the proteome so that the proteins required to be faithfully translocated in those membrane lipid rafts are there in the right molar concentration. Okay. All right. So initially, ceramide was shown to directly interact with cathepsin. Second, the fusion of the S. aureus contained phagosomes with acidified lysosomes will allow alpha toxin to obtain lysosomal permeabilization, and therefore promote the translocation of the cathepsins. And in fact, clinical studies have classically demonstrated that mere leakage of lipopolysaccharide from bacteria invaded phagolysosomes, or in fact, cytosolically localized gram-negative bacteria may activate the non-canonical process of NLRP3 inflammasome induction by hijacking various components of the events I just went through. Okay. And there's just one bacteria we're talking about here. One component of the bacterial toxin, the alpha toxin. Staph aureus has other toxins. Now, it's well established that release of cathepsins caused by lysosomal rupture is necessary for that specific inflammasome activation. We know this because the pharmacological inhibitor CA-074ME prevents the inflammasome signaling activating and interleukin 1 beta production upon exposure to alpha toxin. Okay. Now, besides all of that, the mature form of cathepsin D follows the ceramide production from ASM and a bacterial extract of Lactobacillus casei cell wall fragments will also induce the formation of the NLRP3 inflammasome and co-localization of NLRP3 with ASC and or caspase 1. All of this response sequelae is dependent on that cathepsin B activation, which was blocked by a siRNA to the acidic sphingomyelinase transcript, or simply by disruption of ceramide membrane rafts with non-ionic detergent in cell culture. Okay, so you're getting the idea how multiple integration of multiple processes are occurring for this event to play a role in inflammation. So the take-home message here really is that acidic sphingomyelinase ceramide induces NLRP3 inflammasome activation through the lysosome cathepsin B pathway. But I want you to recall, well, I just made that statement, and that's what we just showed in this data from this paper. I want you to recall that the activation of the NLRP3 inflammasome shows a moderate only and sometimes no response to cathepsin B deficiency. Now, that could suggest, okay, that data point could suggest that a pharmacological cathepsin B inhibitor could exert off-target events or suppress other cathepsins, since cathepsin B triggers the inflammasome activating upon toxin stimulation. Right. So many of these inhibitor studies and even knockout studies I told you a couple lectures ago don't really give you the kind of absolute yes-no answers to the final regulation of the system. Because once you induce a change like a knockout or you add an inhibitor, you titrate the activity with the inhibitor, and then you can maybe even remove the inhibitor and get the original process restarted, it doesn't mean that the addition of an inhibitor or the knockout will mimic what occurs in the normal regulation turnover and finally the removal of the inflammasome activation entirely. Therefore, using drugs that only target certain components of that pathway will be similarly like shooting in the dark. Okay. Now, with a priori biochemically poised activation, which we know exists in the cell, followed by specific stress or a pathogen-induced focused pattern recognition and attention modifying molecular activation, the inflammasome responds with a built-in feedback mechanism that ultimately deplatforms the structure. So the modality that we've been talking about, the classical modality using the pattern recognition toll-like receptor, the reception of that modality doesn't initially discriminate among the various stimulations which are pouring through the kinases and proteases and those nested cascades. And they don't, those the reception of PIRR and TLR don't discriminate until and only until the cell rewrites the elements of the response, eo ipso, thereby, the immunoepigenome via DNA methyltransferase and histone acetylase and histone methylase activities, along with all the micro and long non-coding RNA mediation, which we know provides the temporal acuity with built-in feedback regulatory sequelae for the inflammasome activation. So in a way, the living system responds through inflammasome-mediated inflammation after pathogen infection or cell proliferation or a disease state like dyslipidemia. Those are the three we have talked about, via a molecular sequence that is always becoming in perpetuity, so that biochemical modification can promote the removal of the pathogen or the cancer cell while preserving the healthy tissue via anti-inflammatory macrophage recruitment. Remember those anti-inflammatory interleukin 10 produced by M2 macrophages. And remember the recruitment of the Tregs, which will temporarily work downstream to shut off T helper cell and T helper cell synapsing with dendritic cells to further enhance the inflammatory response. Okay. So all of this has to do with the control over the initial reception activation sequence. Once that's controlled naturally by the components that turn over and shut it down, it is very obvious that the system is set to remove, for example, the invading pathogen. Remember the whole pyritosis discussion we had? We were discussing how pyritosis and components of ferritosis, the iron being released from the mitochondrion, generating ferritosis, and necrotosis, killing off cells so that invading microorganisms like that staph bacterium is sent out where it will then be annihilated by pyritosis. All that is functioning in real time, all with a priori regulation. A priori, by that I mean it's already set up. Yet, when it's functioning and turning over and being further regulated, it is being processed by all the different markups that we just went through, that I just described to you. All the subcellular translocations, all the release or lack of release of certain hydrolases or proteases, or ultimately even the pro-inflammatory cytokines, generating then the whole T and B cell, remember, activation. And we didn't really even discuss the chemokine pathways, secretory pathways, and chemokines are also generated, and the chemokines are going to open up then a gradient for T cells and B cells to migrate to that site of infection, or cancer cell proliferation, or dyslipidemic inflammatory response. All right, so let's look at the time. I'm afraid I'm going to go over again. I don't want to do that. All right, we're at 24 minutes. So this is what we're doing. We're using a dialectical method here. And we're comparing two different systems, and then we're asking what emerges from the two when they interact coherently. Because one way to get thesis, antithesis, synthesis, which is only one way of considering what a dialectic is, a Hegelian consideration, really, which was put together, I would say, in Kant's Critique of Judgment. Only he didn't use that exact terminology. Sometime I could get into that. But at any rate, We're using a dialectical method, and that requires biochemical, physiological, molecular, genetic, immunological, and indeed ultimately the biomedical events to undergo analyses and then trace back to the beginning. And that will subsequently provide at least some information on the coherent, real-time, a priori, now developed fully synthesis. Okay. And when I say now developed fully, that means starting from the a priori poising to the a posteriori result. Okay. Now, you know I've said this many times because I'm a biochemist. I've been a biochemist for like 4 decades, more than that now. I am still intellectually humbled every time I start putting together this better understanding of what's going on in cellular biochemistry. Much as I've studied biochemistry, I realize I know still next to nothing of what actually occurs in the plenum of complexity in the intact living organism. Because so many events are happening simultaneously, and yet they're interacting. And they're not interacting in a linear way. Nothing like a linear way, right? Just think about simple feedback loops and feed-forward loops, no longer linear, right? So the biochemical foundations of life occur simultaneously and yet synchronously. And they're doing it in such a way to avoid host death. This is in terms of an inflammatory response. Now, it takes really a robustly educated human intellect to tease this out. And still, it is in a very clunky way because we're still trying to segregate out all the components here and try to put them back together. A clunky way compared to what the cell is doing all the time. It's all the information is already there, including how to deal with new information all the time, because the environment and the genome generate the immunoepigenomic mediation of the living system. Right? So this is why it's clear to me that there are no pharmaceuticals or even naturally occurring molecules added back or removed or otherwise changed in molar concentration or altered when they are expressed in terms of the temporal sequence. Any of those acting as mimetics and even with mechanisms that are channeling agonism and antagonism that will redirect the well-conserved, highly regulated, and of course still allosterically controlled bioenergetic and enthalpic processes of the hierarchically controlled living state. There's no way that they're going to be able to, in any normal process, smoothly integrate into all of that complexity without causing multiple perturbations, some of which may be benign and totally recovered from because it would just simply be another stress to the cellular system, right? The off-label effects of some pharmaceutical or some nutraceutical. So it could just not cause any further corruption of the system or anything besides that, which could include corruptions in the system. Okay. Now, this includes immunomodulators, such as monoclonal antibodies, the programmed cell death inhibitors, the CTL4 blockers, again, various kinds of siRNAs. They all share the undesirable effect of corrupting, at some level, normal regulation. This is Dr. Dan Guerra on a Tuesday evening from Authentic Biochemistry, saying bye for now.